We are here today to celebrate the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who in his own words was maladjusted. We will explore how he defined maladjusted, how he became maladjusted, and how he taught many of us to be maladjusted.
But it's dangerous to be maladjusted, isn't it? What King saw as maladjustment, others saw as extremism. Was King an extremist?
Martin Luther King Jr. entered Morehouse College, a distinguished Negro institution of Atlanta from which both his father and grandfather had graduated. King, a freshman at the age of 15, was young and impressionable. He read Henry David Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience in his freshman year and noted in his autobiography that he was deeply moved. Here, in this courageous New Englander's refusal to pay his taxes and his choice of jail rather than support a war that would spread slavery's territory into Mexico, King wrote, "I made a first contact with the theory of nonviolent resistance." The teachings of Thoreau, King wrote, came alive in our civil rights movement. Indeed, they are more alive than ever before, whether expressed in a sit-in at lunch counters, a freedom ride into Mississippi, a peaceful protest in Albany, Georgia, a bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. These are outgrowths of Thoreau's insistence that evil must be resisted and no moral person can patiently adjust to injustice. It is a source of pride for us Unitarian Universalists that one of our own, Henry David Thoreau, helped to launch our civil rights movement. Although he never faced the menacing threat that finally overcame Martin Luther King, he wasn't afraid to take personal risk for his stand. This weekend, when we set aside time to celebrate King's legacy, we might also reflect on our own, the example set by Henry David Thoreau and what it means to us today. Are we living true to our conscience? Have we set aside our comfort, even just for a day, to take a stand against injustice? Would we be willing to take such a risk of nonconformity, to let others think us foolish or wrong, and to give up personal gain for the sake of principle?
After Morehouse and his introduction to Thoreau, King moved to Crozier Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, a very liberal school, where he was awarded the Bachelor of Divinity in 1951. While at Crozier, he was elected president of a predominantly white senior class, was class valedictorian, won a prize as an outstanding student, and earned a fellowship for graduate studies. During this time, King also rebelled against his father's conservatism and made no secret about drinking beer, smoking, and playing pool. He became enamored of a white woman and went through a difficult time before he could bring himself to break off the relationship. During his last year at Crozier, King began to read the iconoclastic theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr and his challenge to liberal theology and thus to King's own ideas at the time became the most important single influence on King's intellectual development, far surpassing his later interest in Mahatma Gandhi. He enrolled in graduate school at Boston University in the fall of 51. In Boston, he met and married Coretta Scott, a young woman of uncommon intellectual and artistic attainments. In 1954, Martin Luther King became pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church of Montgomery, Alabama, a city where a well-organized chapter of the NAACP was already established and working to find a way to focus attention on the black community's dissatisfaction with segregation.
We think of one woman's simple action of refusing to give up her seat as launching the Montgomery bus boycott. This, in fact, was not the case. Months of organizing preceded Park's decision to stay put in her seat when the bus driver told her to move to the back of the bus. Rosa Parks herself was an activist and an organizer and secretary for the NAACP in Montgomery. She was not just a simple department store seamstress, as the mythology would have it. She was part of a movement that had begun long before she was taken to jail for keeping her seat on the bus. And because she was already part of a movement, when the time came to act, she was ready. When the time came to put the word out about the boycott early in December of 1955, King and the rest of the ministers in Montgomery, joined by civic leaders and professionals in the African American community, the network was in place. Everyone knew, don't take the bus on Monday morning. And on the day of days, as King called it, no one did. King and his family watched from the front window of their home as first one, then two, then three buses rolled by, empty, but for a couple of white passengers. I jumped in my car, King wrote, and for almost an hour I cruised down every major street and examined every passing bus. By this time, I was jubilant. Instead of the 60% cooperation we had hoped for, it was becoming apparent that we had reached almost 100%. During these days of boycott, King was arrested. His home was bombed. He was subjected to personal abuse, but at the same time, he emerged as a first-rank leader and spokesman. This was King's triumph. The day of days was over, and at a meeting that night, they started a movement that would gain national recognition, whose echoes would ring in the ears of people of every nation, a movement that would astound the oppressor and bring new hope to the oppressed. Thoreau's legacy of creative protest had come into its own. The 382-day boycott led the bus company to change its regulations, and the U.S. Supreme Court declared such segregation unconstitutional.
Martin Luther King's book, Stride Toward Freedom, tells one of the central stories of the civil rights movement, the Montgomery bus boycott. It was during this action, the resistance and arrest of Rosa Parks, and the subsequent protest, that King articulated his understanding of civil disobedience. Stride Toward Freedom not only set the tone, it became the guidebook for the civil rights movement. While the action was pending, King wrote, I was forced for the first time to think seriously on the nature of the boycott. Up to this time, I had uncritically accepted this method as the best course of action. Now certain doubts began to bother me. Were we following an ethical course of action? Is the boycott method basically unchristian? Isn't it a negative approach to the solution to the problem? Even if lasting practical results came from such a boycott, would immoral means justify moral ends? Each of these questions demanded honest answers. As I thought further, I came to see that what we were really doing was withdrawing our cooperation from an evil system rather than withdrawing our economic support from the bus company. The bus company, being an external expression of the system, would naturally suffer. But the basic aim was to refuse to cooperate with evil. At this point, I began to think about Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. I remembered how, as a college student, I'd been moved when I first read this work. I became convinced that what we were preparing to do in Montgomery was related to what Thoreau had expressed. We were simply saying to the white community, we could no longer let our cooperation to an evil system. Something began to say to me, the one who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as the one who helps to perpetrate it. The one who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it. So in order to be true to one's conscience and true to God, a righteous person has no alternative but to refuse to cooperate with an evil system. This, I felt, was the nature of our action. From this moment on, I conceived of our movement as an act of massive non-cooperation. From then on, I rarely used the word boycott.
Dr. Martin Luther King told us in one of his sermons, "Everybody passionately seeks to be well-adjusted, but there are some things in our world to which those of goodwill must be maladjusted. I confess that I never intend to become adjusted to the evils of segregation and the crippling effects of discrimination, to the moral degeneracy of religious bigotry and the corroding effects of narrow sectarianism, to economic conditions that deprive people of work and food, and to insanities of militarism and the self-defeating effects of physical violence." Then Dr. King went on to say, "Human salvation lies in the hands of the creatively maladjusted. We must make a choice. Will we continue to march to the drumbeat of conformity and respectability? Or will we, listening to the beat of a more distant drum, move to its echoing sounds? Will we march only to the music of time, or will we, risking criticism and abuse, march to the soul-saving music of eternity?" If you will allow the preacher in me to come out now, let me say to you that I never did intend to adjust to the evils of segregation and discrimination. I never did intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never did intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I never did intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism, to the self-defeating effects of physical violence. And I call upon all men and women of goodwill to be maladjusted, because it may well be that the salvation of our world lies in the hands of the maladjusted.
Dr. King continued, "So let us be maladjusted, as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out in words that echo across the centuries, 'Let justice run down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.' Let us be as maladjusted as Abraham Lincoln, who had the vision to see that this nation could not exist half slave and half free. Let us be maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could look into the eyes of men and women of his generation and cry out, 'Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you.' I believe it is through such maladjustment that we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice."
And that brings us to the questions. How can we, as Unitarian Universalists, continue the struggle against injustice? In our own time, what must we get maladjusted about? Would not Dr. King encourage us to get maladjusted about an intolerant racism that continues to divide our nation and destroy the moral fabric of the nation? An economic system that allows a few to gain inordinate wealth at the expense of a growing number of the impoverished? A society that still does not guarantee every child the right to an adequate diet, housing, education, and health care. A democratic process that still robs black people of their votes.
Dr. King's spirituality is widely recognized as being deeply Christian, and it certainly was. But you may not know that Unitarianism greatly influenced him. In Soul Work, UU minister Rosemary Bray McNatt relates an interview she had with Coretta Scott King in which she said, I went to Unitarian churches for years, even before I met Martin. And Martin and I went to Unitarian churches when we were in Boston. Reverend McNatt goes on to write, "What surprised and saddened me most was what she said next. And though I'm paraphrasing, the gist of it was this. We gave a lot of thought to becoming Unitarian at what time, but Martin and I realized we could never build a mass movement of black people if we were Unitarian. We echo Reverend McNatt's sadness at this loss of Dr. King in our movement, but an even greater loss is the absence of people of color in our religious community. Many people ask why that is. The answers are complex, but Dr. King gave an explanation that is accurate, if difficult for us to hear. He said, liberalism failed to see that reason by itself is little more than an instrument to justify man's defensive ways of thinking. Reason, devoid of the purifying power of faith, can never free itself from distortions and rationalizations."
Martin Luther King, however, did not entirely sever his ties with Unitarianism. He addressed the General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association in the summer of 1966 in Hollywood, Florida. He said, most revolutions have been based on hope and hate. The difference in the revolution that is taking place in our country is that it has maintained the hope, and at the same time, it has added the dimension of love. Now, it is nonsense to urge people to love their violent oppressors in an affectionate sense. But we must see the meaning of love in higher terms of understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all, an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. When one rises to love on that level, he or she loves a person who does the evil deed while hating the deed. I believe it is possible, and in our best moments in this struggle, we have tried to adhere to it. We have been able to stand up in the face of our most violent opponents and say in substance, "We cannot in good conscience obey your unjust laws because such non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. So threaten our children, bomb our homes, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And one day we will not only win freedom for ourselves, but we will so appeal to your heart and to your conscience that we will win you in the process. And our victory will be a double victory. This is our message in the nonviolent movement."
Dr. King said that the only way to ultimately change humanity and make for the society we all long for is to keep love at the center of our lives. He wasn't talking about romantic love. He was talking about understanding creative, redemptive goodwill for all humanity, to use his words. To use our Unitarian Universalist words, he affirmed the inherent worth and dignity of all persons. All are equally deserving of our respect and understanding. While standing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in the Reverend Dr. King delivered his most famous speech, "I Have a Dream," to 250,000 unsegregated marchers on the March to Washington in 1963. Among other things, King said, "I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith with which I return to the South. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we'll be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able together to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day.
A reason we need to talk about racism and classism is that to not talk about and deal with it is to diminish our spirituality. This was at the heart of Martin Luther King Jr.'s message. Any religion which professes to be concerned about the souls of men and women, he proclaimed, and is not concerned about the social and economic conditions that can scar the soul, is a spiritually moribund religion only waiting for the day to be buried. King must have wondered whether he was asking too much. In the letter from Birmingham City Jail, King wrote that he had gradually gained a bit of satisfaction from being considered an extremist. Was not Jesus an extremist, he asked? And Amos, and Paul, and Martin Luther, and Abraham Lincoln, and Thomas Jefferson. So the question, he concluded, is not whether we will be extremist, but what kind of extremist will we be? Will we be extremist for hate, or will we be extremist for love? Will we be extremist for the preservation of injustice, or will we be extremist for the cause of justice?
These are important questions in King's time and in ours. If the church has moral leadership, we must use it. To use it, we must take a stand. Many will view a courageous position as extreme. There are all kinds of risks that go with it. But the strength that comes from faith is not meant to maintain the status quo, as King would say. It is meant to make the world a better place. We need each other to challenge our attitudes and actions and to support us in this difficult struggle. We need to talk about our concerns and fears and to listen to each other's ideas and dreams. Prophetic visionaries are threats to those who are adjusted to the status quo, which are benefiting from a system that is stacked against the poor, the outcast, and the powerless. Dreamers stand on the mountaintop and see a vision of what can be instead of what is. But there are those who only want what is. We need each other to help challenge our attitudes and actions and to support us in this difficult struggle. We need to talk about our concerns and fears and to listen to each other's ideas and dreams. Let us be maladjusted. Let us take our inspiration from our great leader, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., to move from dissonance and pain to justice and hope. He taught us how. Now it is we who shall overcome.